Blog Talk Radio.
Get everything ready here. Somebody's got to take Twitter away from me, man. I need to go in Twitter timeout. I've been Twitter debating all day about stupid shit. You know how it is. I have a general rule not to debate on Twitter, and then I break it every day. It's actually, I believe the rule was, Dave Rubin came up with it, don't debate with Twitter eggs. And I held true to that. Then my standard became don't debate on Twitter. I was solidly in that camp for a good 3 months, 4 months, about that. And then, boom, the wheels came off, drove into a ditch, debating. And the thing is, like, why would I debate on Twitter when I have this forum? Anything that I'm thinking about, angry about, want to explain further, want to break down, like, I have a fucking gigantic YouTube platform, and I'm like, no, I will tweet at you in 140 characters, goddammit, and you're going to agree with me. It's just stupid, especially because we all know, I mean, you're never, ever, ever going to convince everybody. But anyway, a lot of great stuff to talk about today. So there's some interesting speculation about what's going to happen in the election on the Democratic side. A lot of people disagree with me on this one too, but Joe Biden getting in the race, is that good or bad? Why not? I'm going to explain why I don't think it is. I'm leaning towards I don't think it is. And then as we move along here, the Democrats are trying a new gun reform push, which is interesting. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia, in this case Saudi Arabia primarily, but the U.S. right there with them, bombed another wedding. God, we're so stupid. How many times? How many stories? Every single fucking week I feel like we do stories now. Wedding bombed, funeral bombed, a hospital bombed. Bill O'Reilly does an anti-drug rant straight out of Reefer Madness. And just such a great article, man. There was a great article on Vice News about a fundamentalist Muslim who was gay. He was in the closet. And how he struggled with that on a daily basis. And then what he ended up doing to get out of it. I mean, it really is just an amazing story, written really well, too. Like, there's some people who the way they write, it just kind of pierces through. And it gets, like, directly into your brain and you get it. And then there's other people who write, and you're like, why are you speaking in this weird way? It doesn't land. This article landed, so I'm going to quote quite a bit of it. And we got our usual Glenn Beck nonsense. Oh, and I'm also going to be going after the PC crowd today pretty fervently. God damn, it's so stupid. I don't know why. What's happened? I guess it really is college campuses. Like, that's the issue. Because there's weird speech codes, and it's not liberal, but people think it's liberal. I don't know why they think it's liberal. When I read you the way that they're trying to police language, I mean, it's just out and out authoritarianism. It's unbelievable. All right, so we'll talk about all that and much more. Let me get started here, and we'll kick it off with a little bit of the speculation that's happening today about the election on the Democratic side. All right. So there's some interesting speculation around the internet today about the election. Vice President Joe Biden is still considering running for president, And word is that he'll make up his mind at some point this month. Now, the evidence suggests that he indeed will run. So he leaked to the New York Times a story about how his son's dying wish was that he run for president again. And I'm of the belief that I don't think you leak that unless you plan on eventually saying, yes, of course I'm running. But get this, quote, perhaps the most interesting tidbit from the report is that Biden apparently hinted at a joint ticket with Senator Elizabeth Warren in a meeting with her earlier this year. So now the speculation is that perhaps we'll have a Biden-Warren ticket, and the polling data right now shows that Biden has some support. He ran for president a few other times. It didn't go very well. But the polls show, the early polls, again, you should throw in that word early when discussing it at this point, they do show that he has some support. And there's some debate going on among the liberal community and the progressive community. And it is true that as of right now, the polling shows if Biden gets in the race, it's actually a good thing for Bernie Sanders, because Biden will primarily take votes from Hillary Clinton because he's more of an establishment Democrat. Hillary is more of an establishment Democrat. These are big players within the Democratic Party. So the crowd that's more inclined to vote for Hillary could be swayed towards Biden if they like Biden more. But I'm actually skeptical in regards to these early polls here, because I think it's slightly misleading, in the same way that if you look at the polls in 2008 on the Republican side, and Rudy Giuliani was winning, in the same way that people thought, oh, he's going to win, look, he's leading. I think it's misleading in the same way, because Joe Biden is going to run a pretty progressive campaign. Now, understand, that doesn't mean that he governs as a true progressive. He doesn't. He's done some good things. The Violence Against Women Act is one of the main things that he did. But he is, in many ways, a Wall Street sellout, and, you know, we can go down the list. He's, in terms of governing, he's much more like Obama or Hillary than he would be like Bernie Sanders. But in terms of running his campaign, he will definitely run a campaign to the left of Hillary Clinton. He will position himself to the left of Hillary Clinton. And if he does that, then the fear is not only that, oh, maybe he'll take votes away from Clinton, which I think we'd all agree is a good thing, but no, he might actually take some votes away from Bernie Sanders. So the idea that it's a guarantee that Biden running is a good thing for Bernie Sanders, I simply don't believe that. And I'm at the point now where I honestly don't think it would be a bad thing if the race just stayed as it is right now. If we had Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, and Jim Webb. Because Martin O'Malley and Jim Webb will promptly shit the bed, as they already have. And it's going to come down to Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton, and it's a race between a true progressive who can frame debates properly and somebody like Hillary Clinton who's trying to pretend to be a progressive, as her record shows that she's a center-right corporatist Democrat. And she's also just not, it just so happens, not very likable in a campaign, as we saw against President Obama. She was just vicious and came across insincere. And nobody is more genuine than Bernie Sanders. So if it stayed like it is right now, I think Bernie has a better chance of winning. But if Biden gets in, a lot of people say it'll help Bernie. I'm not convinced it'll help Bernie. And since the dynamic right now is starting to show that it's better for Bernie, I'm not so sure I'd like Biden in the race. And I'm also not so sure. You know, he's got this weird thing of just, he's the VP, man. I tweeted this the other day, how for him to become president strikes me as like, it's like a guy who's in the friend zone. Like, no, you're in the friend zone now, dude. She's not that into you. You're just the friend. That's what it is with Biden. Like, oh, you want to be president? That's cute. But you're the fucking VP. Let's get serious here. That's who you are. That's what you do. You're going to be president? No, you're VP. That's how we know you. And this happens all the time. I mean, Al Gore. What happened when Al Gore was VP? He ran for president and he lost. Why? Because he's fucking VP. That's what he is. Now, the funny thing is, that's a bad example, because he actually won. He won by 500,000 votes in the popular vote. But since we have the Electoral College, and Jeb Bush was the governor of Florida, and a bunch of fuckery behind the scenes, George Bush ended up winning. But I think you get the overall point, that it just, I don't think I don't think it'll work out too well for Joe if he runs, and I do think that he is going to run. All right, so there's that. Now, we go from some speculation about the race to Bernie Sanders doing some speculation of his own, but his speculation might indeed be facts. Not surprising for a guy like Bernie. All right. Bernie Sanders went on Morning Joe, and he made an argument that has the establishment baffled about who his voters will be. So he said the following, quote, "There are more than a few Republicans for Bernie Sanders out there. Don't be surprised if we do well with a number of Republicans. I think the message that we are bringing forth, that we have got to come together to say Wall Street and corporate America cannot continue to dominate our political and economic life, that we need an economy that works for working families and not just the 1%. A lot of Republicans will respond to that as well." Yeah. Now, again, the establishment response to this is something along the lines of... Shaggy Bernie with his messed up hair thinks he's going to get Republicans. So they don't believe it. Very simply put, they don't believe it. Now, one can excuse the establishment for falling into the trap of being establishment douchebags, but the reality is Bernie is absolutely correct. And I'm not just saying that because I like Bernie Sanders. I'm saying that for issues-related reasons. So to get specific here, when you poll the American people, the majority of Republicans say, don't cut education spending, don't cut Medicare, don't cut Medicaid, don't cut Social Security, raise taxes on the rich, do universal background checks for gun purchases, raise the minimum wage. There are a number of issues where a majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats agree, where an overwhelming majority of the American people agree. And the only guy in the race who's representing those positions and standing up and arguing for them is Bernie Sanders. So as long as they're not so deep in that right-wing bubble that just the name Bernie Sanders turns them off, you know, just the fact that he's described himself as a social democrat or a democratic socialist, if that doesn't turn them off, as long as they listen to what the fuck he's saying, a lot of them are going to vote for him. Now, as Bernie laid out himself when he gave a speech at, I think it was Liberty University or something like that, some Christian right-wing university, he said, okay, guys, bottom line is we're not going to agree on everything, and that's okay. And he went down a list of things. One of those things is just social issues in general, whether it's gay marriage, even though a majority of young Republicans are now for it, or whether it's abortion. There's a number of issues where, yeah, there's genuine differences, and that's fine. But in terms of very important economic issues, he's not just representing liberals. He's representing the American people, and he's representing a majority of Republicans. Bernie's the only guy who's standing up and arguing for protectionism. Now, protectionism is a dirty word that you're not allowed to be in favor of that anymore in the mainstream. You have to always, in all circumstances, be in favor of so-called free trade. But Bernie Sanders is one of the guys who says, no, no more of these so-called free trade deals, because in reality, they're just outsourcing deals, and they're hurting America. I mean, the only other person who comes even somewhat close to Bernie's position on this, believe it or not, is Donald Trump. And he's one of those guys who... he's a blind squirrel who finds an acorn every once in a while. He's a broken clock that's right twice a day. But Bernie's been making this argument for decades now. I mean, he stood up, he fought against NAFTA. You go down the list. He's written articles against the World Trade Organization and against GATT. He's totally against the TPP. And he does it because he cares about the middle class. And you don't have to be a liberal to see that he cares about America and he cares about the middle class. So is it possible that a guy like Bernie Sanders would get a significant chunk of the Republican vote? I say yes. And the establishment might scoff, and they might laugh, and they might mock us, But they're doing a surface analysis. Oh, his name is Bernie Sanders. Oh, he's a social democrat. Oh, he's a Jew atheist. Oh, nobody's going to like him. But remember, if you just listen to what Bernie's saying, he'll swing some voters. Because he actually cares about economic issues. He actually cares about the American people. And that's a nonpartisan thing. People can get on board with that. Yeah, man, there are plenty of issues where, I mean, there's a gap that's not going to be mended, fixed, whatever the right word is, between the right and the left. There are areas where we absolutely agree and very few people ever discuss it. Like we were talking about the other day on the issue of tax cuts. This idea that there are people on the left who can't wait to raise taxes on families of four living on $40,000, that's simply not true. There's this caricature that's been made of the left that, like, oh, they always want tax hikes. Yeah, but that's not correct. Have you listened to any arguments any, not only grassroots liberals have made, but Democratic politicians have made? In fact, it's the exact opposite. The only people really arguing to raise taxes on the middle class and the poor are Republican politicians. Bobby Jindal's tax plan released just the other day said he wants everybody to pay federal income tax, which means that the 45 or so percent of the American people who are too poor to pay income tax, he's going to make them pay anyway. So they're the guys who are really the party of tax increases. They want to raise taxes on the people who need tax cuts the most. And then they want to turn around and cut the taxes of the people who can afford to pay more taxes, namely the top 1%. All right, now, we're going to jump into this gun issue because, I mean, we have some kind of good news on this, I guess you could say. The Democrats are making another push on gun reform. MSNBC. I got to learn how to speak right since I do a talk show. The Democrats are making another push on gun reform. MSNBC reports, quote, Senate Democrats will unveil plans for gun control reforms that include closing background check loopholes, expanding the background check database, and tightening regulations on illegal gun purchases. The push is being led by Chuck Schumer and Debbie Stabenow. The bill calls for, quote, shutting down the illegal pipeline of guns, specifically straw purchasing, where one person buys a firearm for someone not legally allowed to. The senators will demand that all domestic abusers are banned from purchasing firearms and that people are not allowed to buy guns without a complete background check. So this is a step in the right direction. They go on in the article to explain that this is very similar to the Manchin-Toomey bill, which was filibustered by the Republicans not that long ago after Sandy Hook. And what that bill was just basically a watered-down background check bill. Now, from my preliminary reading of this bill, or I shouldn't even say that because I haven't read the bill itself. I've just read a few articles about the bill. It appears like this bill is a little bit stronger than the Manchin-Toomey bill, but again, it's a step in the right direction. Now, here's the problem. You guys have heard me make this argument before, but I need to bring it up again, unfortunately. The problem is they just started the debate yet again conceding so much. See, they already have the remnants of getting their ass beat and getting the bill filibustered in their mind from the last time. So they kind of think, well, the debate was ongoing the entire time, and now we'll just propose a similar bill to the one before, and maybe it'll pass this time because there's another mass shooting. No. You fundamentally misunderstand the way you're supposed to play politics. Have you ever bought a car, for example? And what do you do in the negotiation? And what does the car salesman try to do in the negotiation? I was a car salesman, I know. The way it works is, you know, you say the price is higher than it is. They want it for much lower than you own it for. And then you meet somewhere in the middle. And you guys both, your starting positions are both pretty absurd. That's the way it works. Well, why not do that for the fucking gun debate also? I mean, the least you can do for your starting position in the debate is to say, we want to ban assault weapons, we want to ban high-capacity magazines and limit the number of bullets to 5. We want to do a universal background check, get rid of the gun show loophole. We want to do a giant gun buyback program. We want to do a new permit system that's tiered that says, yeah, you can have more guns if you're, you know, some kind of a hunter and you go through the right process, but you can't have them if you're in the city environment and this and that. I mean, you should propose a real comprehensive thing here where the goal is to put a dent in the over 300 million guns that we have in the United States. But you didn't do that. That wasn't the starting position. You started with where the compromise should be. So now where do you go from here? If your argument is just expand background checks a little, well, then when the Republicans come back and say, blow me, we're going to do nothing, where do you go? I guess we could water down the background check more and make it less effective. And then what are the Republicans going to blow me more? So that's not going to work. But if you start with ban assault weapons, do a giant gun buyback program, do a universal background check, limit the high-capacity magazines, go down a fucking list, then what are they going to do? Blow me. And then you go, oh, you want to play this game? Okay. Then you add more to the list of what you want to do. And then eventually, the way politics is played is, if they don't want to negotiate with you, if they don't want to meet in the middle, well, that's when you take your argument and you hit the airwaves. And when you hit the airwaves, you come with a fucking bucket of insults with you, and you start hurling them. And they don't – let's be clear. It doesn't have to be ad hominem attacks. It doesn't have to be incorrect attacks. The facts are enough to make the Republicans look like callous, heartless bastards. So you go out there. You start citing statistics. You start talking about 36,000, between 32,000 and 36,000 gun deaths in America on average every single year. You start talking about – the personal stories of the people who were gunned down in the Oregon shooting, the people who were gunned down at Sandy Hook. Bring one of the family members with you. They'll be happy to come on the Sunday shows and talk about how the Republicans are fascists. Bring opinion polls. Say over 90% of the American people want a universal background check, and the Republican response is piss off. Why are the Republicans fascists? Why do they not care about what the American people want democratically? You make the argument, you hammer them so fucking hard that they will buckle and they will compromise at some point. And then, let's say they don't. Let's say we get to the point where they don't, even given that. Well, you say, okay, I'm going to go to the places where Republicans are elected, which are blue districts or blue-leaning districts. We're going to pour in so much money to your race there that your political career guaranteed is going to be over. So if you want to, you're a Republican from a blue state or a blue district, you want to oppose gun reform, do it at your own risk because your career is going to be over. I can guarantee you that. And then what will happen? People respond to incentives. They respond to pressure. You will win if you do that. But what do the Democrats do? They fought a little bit last time, but they buckled immediately and they didn't get anything. The background check bill was filibustered. Then they didn't hit the airwaves again and mock the Republicans for it and go to work. And then now they're just bringing up a weak bill again. Well, what the fuck do you expect is going to happen? You just think, oh, that's it. They're going to go for it now, even though they didn't go for it and they filibustered it the last time. Why would they go for it? Because they know that if they block it again, you're not going to do dick about it. You're not going to go out there on the Sunday shows and embarrass them and make fools of them and expose them. So why would they? They wouldn't do it. Why would they? And they're also getting money from the gun manufacturers. So they're going to be more loyal to the gun manufacturers than you. You have to shame them, you have to expose them, and you have to make an argument, and you're not doing that because you don't know how to play politics. And what's so sad about this is an issue, guys, where the Democrats are not bought off. So on other issues, like issues involving Wall Street and economic stuff, the Democrats are bad because they're bought. So they're acting in favor of their donors and screwing over the American people. So there's like a perverse incentive behind the scenes which explains why they're weak or just why they're bad. Here, there is no perverse incentive for them because the overwhelming majority of the Democrats don't take money from the gun manufacturers and don't take money from the NRA. So they actually, their sentiment and wanting to do something for gun reform is correct, but they still just don't know how to fight for it because they're political idiots. You have to learn what FDR did in the past. You have to learn what LBJ did in the past, and you have to implement it and apply it today. And then if you do it and you get the gun reform, that helps you tremendously for the next election. You get to brag. You get to say, we did X, Y, and Z. Isn't it amazing? Aren't we so great? We care about you. We dragged the idiot Republicans into the year 2015. That's why you're going to vote for us. This is how you play politics. This is how you win. I mean, it's an okay. I'm happy that they brought something up, but what are you going to do when it gets slapped down? That's the question. And the answer is nothing. All right, break time. When we come back, another wedding has been hit by an airstrike. Oh, boy. Then we'll get into Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, and a whole bunch more. All right, stay right there, guys. Saudi Arabia, unfortunately. I mean, you want to talk about an Unholy Alliance. God, when these guys get together, they're fucking... Is the word mischievous or mischievous? I always want to say mischievous, but that sounds worse. Mischievous sounds better. All right, let's do it. Another wedding has been hit by a Saudi-U.S. airstrike in Yemen. The New York Times reports, quote, airstrikes by a military coalition led by Saudi Arabia hit a house south of the capital on Wednesday, killing at least 23 people who were attending a wedding party. The attack was the second airstrike on a wedding in Yemen in a little over a week, and it added to growing criticism over the coalition's air campaign, which has killed more than 1,100 civilians over the past 6 months, according to the United Nations. On September 28th, coalition warplanes bombed wedding tents on Yemen's Red Sea coast, killing at least 70 people. More than 2,355 civilians have been killed since the fighting began, the majority of them in coalition airstrikes. So the civilian death rate in this war happening now in Yemen, it's over 50%. And when I say civilian death rate, I mean the death rate of the Saudi airstrikes against the people of Yemen. It's over 50% civilians that they're getting. And also I should mention, I wrongly said in previous segments on this that it's primarily Saudi Arabia doing it and the U.S. is just supplying the weaponry. But now we know it's not just that the U.S. is supplying the weaponry. They're also playing an active role in picking the targets and whatnot for the Saudi bombers to bomb. So where, you know, one could argue equally responsible, since we're hands-on in doing this fighting, which is getting over 50% civilians. So a hospital and a wedding attacked this week. Of course, the hospital was a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan. The U.S. was following the orders, you could say, of Afghan forces who said, hey, can you bomb that for us? Then the U.S. went and bombed it. It was a hospital. Over 20 civilians died. There were doctors who died. It was just a horrific scene. So we had that happen this week, a wedding and a hospital. And in the last 30 days, it's two weddings, because there was the other one in Yemen, and a hospital. And by the way, this is not some kind of extremely rare occurrence. Some people think, oh, well, you named three, but yeah, they were all accidents, and that was all that ever happened. The U.S. never does stuff like this. Our allies never do stuff like this. Well, we know that the U.S. and our allies attacked a maternity hospital in Baghdad in 2003, we attacked the largest hospital in Ramadi in 2006. We attacked a hospital in Belgrade, Serbia in 99, an outdoor market and a hospital in the Serbian city of Nice on May 7th, 1999. We attacked a hospital in Somalia in 1993. And this, of course, doesn't mention other attacks that we've done against pharmaceutical facilities, for example. It doesn't include a common practice, which is bombing the funerals of Taliban operatives, even knowing that women and children will be there, but we bomb anyway in the hopes that maybe we get one or two more Taliban members. It also doesn't include the fact that we've categorized all military-aged males in a lot of these conflicts as the enemy, and if we kill somebody who's a military-aged male, we just say, by definition, they were an insurgent or they were a terrorist, and it's guilty until proven innocent. So somebody would need to provide evidence that it's the opposite, that, you know, this person is not a terrorist. And that obviously skews the statistics. So whenever the government says, well, we got 98% the right people, they're, in essence, pulling it out of their ass. And the list goes on and on of all the different ways in which we've perverted this fight. And I think that this is something that people need to be aware of, that there's a real problem with people believing in the United States that since we mean well, therefore, whenever we fuck up, you can't judge it as harshly as when the other side does something fucked up, because we had such great intentions in our hearts that Yeah, it sucks. Yeah, we feel bad when something happens, but it's certainly not a war crime, and certainly nobody should be held accountable. But bottom line, that's nonsense. Now, am I saying that the U.S. is equal in what their goals are to, like, Al-Qaeda, for example? Of course not. Their goal may be to purposefully harm civilians, whereas the U.S. goal is, yeah, we want to kill Taliban people, but we accept a certain number of civilian casualties if we do it. And is it really all that bad a thing when we get the civilians? No. Is it going to prevent us in the future from attacking with loose evidence? No. They do the same with signature strikes. They do that. There's personality strikes and signature strikes with drones. Personality means we know who we're going after, we know where they are, and we're going to attack. Signature strike means, eh, close enough. We have some kind of evidence somewhere that maybe suggests that this might be the right person, but we're going to go for it anyway. That's why it's called a signature strike, not a personality strike. So if you have a cell phone signal from somebody who 2 years ago had that cell phone who was allegedly connected to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, well, then you attack and whatever happens, happens. And again, I think the main point here is the mindset of let's try to avoid all civilian casualties across the board and don't accept any civilian casualties. That's not the mindset. So we absolutely need to morally judge what our government is doing. Guys, if something happens once and it was a pure accident, I get it. I get it. If something happens twice, all right, it's getting a little fishy, but it is what it is. If something happens, I gave you, what, 8 examples here when we've attacked places that you're not allowed to attack under international law. Then it's a fucking pattern. If somebody in the U.S. commits manslaughter and somehow it's proven, no, this was a total accident, man. He was smoking a cigarette. He dropped it while he was driving. He veered off the road and hit somebody. It was horrendous, but it was an accident. I can see that. But if the same guy kills people 83 times, well, now I'm going to have to question your intent. I'm going to have to question your motive. And the thing is, motive is it's a spectrum like anything else. And while you might say, hey, Al-Qaeda's on one end of the spectrum where they're trying to do harm to civilians, that's the whole point, and other terrorist organizations are on that end, the idea that the U.S. and our allies are just on the other end of the spectrum of we have pure good motives, we're always trying to get the right people, and we will never strike if we think we'll kill even one civilian, that's just not true. That's just not where we are on that spectrum. We're obviously somewhere more in the middle where civilian casualties, yeah, they're acceptable depending on the situation. And the problem is when you are the most powerful and the biggest military on earth and you and your allies are the ones who are doing all this fighting, that middle ground for intent starts to look a hell of a lot like bad intent because you've killed so many people because you're doing the most fighting. No, it's unbelievable, man, and we can't accept this. Guys, you're responsible for what your government does. If you're the U.S. or if you're one of our allies, you know, and you look at stuff like this, you can't just sit by idly and let them do this when it's your fucking tax money funding this nonsense. We got to stand up. We got to speak out against it. We got to let the world know we're not in agreement with this. We got to try to vote for the right people. There's a laundry list of things we got to do. Get money out of politics so the military-industrial complex doesn't have nearly as much influence on the government as it does right now. There's a million and one things that we need to do, but we certainly, certainly cannot passively sit there and let the government do stuff like this. And then all we do is judge other people for other things and not hold our own government accountable for their crimes. Because these indeed are crimes. And to just wash it away by saying, well, we meant well, or well, it was our ally, so it's not really as big of a deal, that's just complete and utter bullshit in the same way that people trying to pretend torture was okay when we did it is bullshit. All right, let's go to Bill O'Reilly, and he did a hilarious drug rant here that you're going to see. Actually, you know what? Let me not do the Bill O'Reilly one, because I have, oh yeah, here it is. This is kind of linked in to the story we were just doing. I'm going to save the Bill O'Reilly for one after this, but let me do Obama's awesome contradiction. So there was a moment that was caught in the White House the other day, And the White House released this video. It's Obama talking to a bunch of veterans, and the veterans saying, "We love the Iran deal, and thankfully you don't want to send us into combat first and ask questions later. You want to try for diplomacy first. And we applaud you, Mr. President, for doing that and caring about peace." And President Obama, in that environment, responds kindly and is like, "You know what, you're right. These guys on the right, man, they're the real problem. You know, they're hawkish. They want to start wars all over the place. And I'm not like that. I mean, I'm a good liberal Democrat. I care about peace. This is what I'm fighting for." So you're going to see first Obama's conversation yesterday in the White House talking to the veterans here where he loves peace. And then right after that, you're going to see President Obama when he was giving his Iran deal speech a few months ago. And look at the direct contradiction.
"Right now, if I would take the advice of some of the members of Congress who are hollering all the time, we'd be in like 7 votes at that point." I'm very bitter. I mean, I can count. We'd be in no trash in 7 places around the world.
"Commander-in-Chief, I have not shied away from using force when necessary. I have ordered tens of thousands of young Americans into combat. I've sat by their bedside sometimes when they come home. I've ordered military action in 7 countries. There are times when force is necessary."
These fucking Republicans, can you believe them? They want to do military actions in 7 countries. Unbelievable. Hey, you guys remember when we were doing military actions in 7 countries that I ordered and that are actually still going on right now? No, that's unreal. That's unreal. Now, here's the thing. That's a complete contradiction, clearly, but is there some truth in a nuanced view of this? So, in other words, is it correct to say, if the Republicans were in charge, perhaps we'd have ground troops in more countries. Perhaps we'd have a bigger, more comprehensive effort happening in 7 different countries. Yes, that's absolutely true. But doesn't that show something damning about the American political system and the military-industrial complex and how we're functioning today? It shows you that those are your two choices. Those are the two establishment parties. Either you have the Republicans, who are in favor of every theoretical and conceivable war ever, or you have the Democrats who, I mean, come on, let's not be crazy here and, like, withdraw from everywhere and, like, not be in a war. Let's keep fighting in Iraq, let's keep fighting in Afghanistan, let's keep fighting in Syria, and let's do a drone campaign in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, and maybe some other places. Those are your two options. So it's either military force, but primarily through airstrikes and drones and very few ground troops in some places, that's the Democrats, or all-out war and invasion and occupation in a variety of different countries, 7 different countries, that's the Republicans. And you can see that view in people like Lindsey Graham or people like John McCain or others. Those are your options. Either continue the empire and keep feeding the military-industrial complex beast, behemoth machine, in a way where, you know, we're doing a war, but we won't call it a war, and we're doing airstrikes, but it's just a little bit. That's the Democrats or the Republicans, where it's like, "Maha, yeah, let's fucking invade everywhere and start killing people and beef up this war machine even more. I'm so happy Halliburton gave me campaign contributions. Yes, Raytheon, you're the best. Make more bombs." Those are your options. Now can you see why the American people are beyond pissed? And then remember, it's your tax dollars funding this nonsense. Under a Democratic administration, we just bombed a hospital in Afghanistan, a Doctors Without Borders hospital. Over 20 people dead. We're responsible for that. That's our tax dollars funding that. And then, you know, we were just saying how the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, they bombed a wedding in Yemen on September 28th, killed a tremendous number of people. Remember, we're working with them. They're doing the bombing, but we're picking the places on the map and helping them, and we're hands-on involved in this. We're giving them all the weapons. So they bombed it then, and then again today, they just bombed another wedding. over 50% of the casualties in the Saudi bombing in Yemen, backed by us, are civilians. And then we're like, well, why do they hate us? I don't understand. Now, I get it, guys. Is there a certain percentage of the hatred against America and the West in general that is based on religious fundamentalism? Absolutely. Religious fundamentalism is a scourge wherever the fuck it exists. That's clear. But is a lot of it based on this? A lot of it is based on, yeah, what? We just invaded your country, killed over 200,000 civilians, riled up a sectarian conflict, and then exploited your natural resources. Why are you so mad? I don't understand. That case, by the way, would be Iraq. No, this stuff does breed hatred. It's an empirical fact that 10 years after the war on terror began, there's been a net increase in terrorists. So it's as an abysmal a failure as the drug war. How the idea with the drug war was limit the number of drugs and try to eradicate drug use, eliminate drug use. Seriously, they said that when they first came up with the drug war. What happened today? The drug use has gone up, and the cartels are more powerful than ever. Same thing with the war on terror. Stop terror, limit terror. Well, you just made terrorism increase, and you just made more terrorists exist. So you just failed. You just suck at what you're doing. And what's the answer? Either continue to do soft empire, like the Democrats do, or you go, you know, the balls to the wall style of the far right, where they want to invade everybody, and they say outright, hey, I believe in American exceptionalism, I believe in neoconservatism, and it's basically a fundamentalist religion, and I will dominate you because I have a right to dominate you because our values are better and we're just better people. This is why Americans are mad. We have to stop letting these assholes use our tax dollars for things we don't want them to use it for. Take all that money, bring it back here, put it into education, put it into healthcare, put it into infrastructure, put it into jobs. There's so many things we could do with it to make our country great. But what we're doing is we're just funding war all around the planet, either when we're engaging in it or we're funding our allies to do it, and then we wonder why everybody hates us. All right, now we go to Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly is going to do an anti-drug rant here, straight out of reefer madness. So let's listen, and then we'll break it down.
Drug criminals work for minority neighborhoods in big cities. Prisons became filled with people of color, prompting the left to label the anti-crime initiatives as racist. Under President Bush the Younger, those accusations got nowhere. Under President Obama, they have been taken very seriously. Mr. Obama and his first attorney general, Eric Holder, believe there is a strong racial element in the American criminal justice system. They ignore the fact, however, that drug dealers have devastated poor neighborhoods and enslaved millions of minority Americans over the years. Mr. Obama and Mr. Holder also believe that selling drugs like crack, heroin, and meth, not a violent crime. Never mind that folks addicted to those drugs commit the majority of property crimes in America, as well as the majority of child abuse. Never mind that drug overdoses kill thousands of Americans every year. Never mind that drug gangs in places like Chicago and Miami are responsible for an incredible amount of violence, as you need guns to compete in the street drug trade. So now, just in time for Halloween, the Justice Department is set to release 6,000 inmates from penitentiaries all across the USA, many of them dope dealers. Also, Congress is getting ready to change some mandatory sentencing, making it easier for pushers and other so-called nonviolent criminals to avoid paying the penalty they deserve. All of this liberal compassion for criminals is having an effect. Violent crime is rising quickly in many places.
Okay, I love that last line. Liberals' compassion for criminals. No, the whole point is, Bill, we don't think that they're criminals. That's the whole point. That's why we want them out of there. We don't think they belong in there. And then he says, oh, crime is rising. Well, wait. We know for sure from the Colorado example, they legalized marijuana at the state level. Crime went down. So what do you mean? First of all, what crime are you referring to? And then, by the way, what does he actually say? He goes on to cite places where it's still illegal. He goes on to cite places where drugs are still illegal, and then he goes, see, it's the liberals and them wanting to legalize drugs that's led to an increase in crime here. What? That makes no sense. Where they have legalized drugs, the crime went down. And then we also have the Portugal example where they decriminalized drugs and crime went down. You know what else went down? Drug use. I know, in Bill O'Reilly's mind, he can't take that. He's like, wait, what? You're allowing people to do it, and then less people did it. Me no get it. Me conservative mind no work like that. Doesn't understand counterintuitive things. God, you're so sad. You can tell he's working backwards from his conclusion. His conclusion is, drugs bad. Minorities bad. Did I say that out loud? Drugs bad. So gotta lock the people up. He said, one of the things he said, drug dealers have devastated poor neighborhoods. Well, wait. Why don't we actually listen to the experts, like Dr. Carl Hart, for example, who says it's the opposite. That basically poverty has devastated poor neighborhoods, by definition. The problem isn't the drugs, the problem is the poverty. And again, we have evidence to back this up. When we did the war on poverty, that boosted many people in minority communities and otherwise out of poverty. I mean, you know, take Social Security, for example. When that program started, it was over 30% of seniors that were living in poverty. And then it dropped to 14%. So that's a success. But he would just dismiss that. He doesn't think, see, in his mind, he thinks the drugs are the problem and the lifestyle, the values are the problem, and that leads to poverty. But what he's missing is systemic economic factors that any idiot with a basic understanding can pick up on. So, in other words, the idea that, for example, when you don't have any jobs available, you will be in poverty, or when the only jobs that are available, you still live in poverty. The problem is not anything else, the values, the drugs. The problem is the economic system. The problem is the system doesn't provide any opportunity. The system doesn't provide a living in any way, shape, or form. So no matter how few drugs are in the community or what the values are, when there are no opportunities, by definition, you can't get out of poverty. But he disregards systemic factors because he wants to blame poor people. He wants to blame black people. He wants to just say, it's your fault. So it's the drugs, it's the values, it's all these things that allow me to take responsibility away from the system, the larger economic system, and just point the finger at you and wash my hands of it and say, I have nothing to do with this. It's got nothing to do with the rest of us. And then also, he says, Obama thinks it's not a crime to sell violent drugs. I'm sorry, Obama thinks it's not a violent crime to sell drugs. Yeah, because it's not. he's amazing. Like, okay, so if you go to CVS, do they sell alcohol there? I think they do. And you buy some hard alcohol or whatever, beer, anything. And you go and you check out. Is the cashier or the owner of the CVS a violent criminal because you just bought a substance? That's a substance which, by the way, is more dangerous than marijuana, for example. Are they a violent criminal? No, of course not. Now, again, he would argue, well, that's already legal, so duh, they're not criminals. But the principle is the point here. Because the idea he's getting at is, well, selling hard drugs, selling a hard substance that'll change your consciousness, that's a violent crime. Well, alcohol is that. Alcohol, again, is worse than a lot of the drugs that are illegal. But not in a million years would he say the CEO of Anheuser-Busch should be dragged away in handcuffs. He wouldn't say it. Why? Because he's a lazy thinker, guys. He's not an intellectual. So he doesn't understand how to apply objective standards and look at things in a serious way. He's just a victim of his own cultural biases. So he was raised in a place and time when alcohol was perfectly socially acceptable. Therefore, alcohol is right. All other drugs that are illegal are wrong. Why? Because the law says so, and I'm not going to look into the roots of the law. I'm not going to check to see if the law is objective. I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to be empirical about it. I'm not going to use logic. I'm just going to say it is what it is. Alcohol, fine. All the others, bad. And that's the end of the conversation. But that's dumb, Bill. That makes you a silly person if you want to engage in the national dialogue on these things, but you have no arguments to back up what you're saying, or at least no solid arguments to back up what you're saying. And finally, he says, well, the drug gangs, they're out of control. Wait. So you're in a rant about how we should keep drugs illegal. You're saying the drug gangs are out of control. Have you considered that maybe the drug gangs are out of control because the substances are illegal? He hasn't. But we know that that's the case. It's not like we don't have examples in history of this, Billy boy. How many times have we brought up prohibition? when alcohol was illegal, the mafia became incredibly powerful, much bigger, and very rich. Because you banned legitimate businesses from selling alcohol, so it went underground to the black market, so criminals are going to be dealing with the product and are going to be selling the product, and they're going to get very rich as a result of it. If you didn't make it illegal, the mafia wouldn't have had a monopoly on the market, and they wouldn't have made more money and been more powerful. Today, it's the same with the drug cartels and drug gangs. The drug gangs can't have power, can't have money, if people can just go to their local CVS or go to their local liquor store or go to their local weed store and get whatever drug they want. All of their power would be taken away from them. The drug cartels would not be able to compete if Big Pharma or fucking Corona or other whatever other company decides to get in on selling the drugs. So the problem is because it's illegal, if you legalize, tax, and regulate the drugs, well, then you make it so the black market disappears and crime drops. Again, we have historical examples. We have the facts on this, but he's not interested in the facts. He's working backwards from his conclusion. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, oh, my God, my favorite story of the day. A gay Muslim fundamentalist and his transition to not being a Muslim fundamentalist. Amazing article. You don't want to miss that. And then Glenn Beck loses his shit and much more. Stay right there, guys.
Thank you.
catch. All right, we're back, guys. We are back. We are back. We are back. All right, let's get into I'm told you this is my favorite story of the day by far here. A gay Muslim fundamentalist and a really good, he just explains well what was going on in his mind, how he was raised, and everything that happened. All right. A man named Sohail Ahmed has an incredible article in Vice News explaining what it's like to grow up as a closeted gay Islamic extremist. Really fascinating stuff. So he said the following, quote, "On 9/11, my hatred was crystallized into something solid and pure. I was 9. My family is from Kashmir in Pakistan, and they raised me and 4 younger siblings in East London. When I was 6, they were befriended by another family in our tower block who swiftly turned them from pretty much apolitical into austere, harsh Salafi Islamists. From then, I saw the world through the prism of radical Islam, and every attempt to make sense of reality was analyzed through it. Life was a battle between good and evil, belief and unbelief. There was a huge contradiction between who I truly was and the odious reactionary views I held. Always the internal voice saying, this is wrong, while being so convinced of my beliefs that they ended up drowning out any semblance of reason. Perhaps the first and greatest of these contradictions was my being a virulent homophobe who was also gay. I've always been attracted to boys, ever since the age of about 8 or 9. I had these feelings pulling me toward them in an enchanting way. Hitting puberty very early, I started messing around with boys at 14 years old. It would always be unknown people, strangers met online or just at secluded spots, because nobody could ever, ever find out. Afterward, I would be so disgusted and utterly ashamed. However intense the pleasure, afterward nothing remained but a hollow ache. There was a prophetic narration that says, when a man lies with another man, the throne of heaven shakes. That's how serious it was. I truly felt like dying." All right, so he goes on to explain that he literally considered doing a terrorist attack. This is how deep he was in Salafism and jihadism, in essence, is that he said, "I considered doing a terrorist attack at one point." And then he goes on to explain, quote, "I began to listen to the doubts and internal nagging voice around 21, looking into evolution, intellectual and philosophical arguments against theism, and studying Enlightenment thinkers really opened up this whole door of reason. The mind forged monocles, I don't know that word, which is pretty sad, of blind and dogmatic faith began to loosen. I swiftly abandoned the whole project of revolutionary Islam after the glaring fallacies and absurdities were illuminated by the warm glow of rationality and empiricism. In a fiery argument with my parents, I spat that Islam probably wasn't even true. They went through my internet history looking for atheist material or whatever, and they found, well, other stuff. My father said I was worse than a dog. He made me go through exorcisms to cast out the devils that were obviously possessing me, and for 2 months I was exorcised every day. After 2 months of this pseudo-spiritual pantomime, I tried to kill myself because it was so fucked up and distressing. The attempt failed, and I had to move out and leave the toxic surroundings, or I really would have died. Paradoxically, when radical, I was much more sexually involved with guys than after coming out. Because it was so wrong and forbidden, it became something fetishized, and thus enchanting and tempting." All right, so I only gave you maybe, I broke the article up. This is like 30% of the article maybe, or 40% of the article. Go check it out on Vice News. It's absolutely incredible. It's a great piece. It had me locked in from beginning to end. And there's a lot to take away from this. So first of all, everything he's saying is, it's almost like on some level, it's obvious to us because we've covered countless stories of the Christian fundamentalists who are super anti-gay, and it just always happens that the loudest, most vehement anti-gay people are always blowing some dude in a New Jersey Turnpike bathroom. That's just the way it works. And a lot of that has to do with when you're raised in a super religious household and you actually internalize the value system, and then you see other people who are gay and open and happy about it, you're jealous and you're pissed because you want to engage in the same things they're engaging in, but you have this moral code that was downloaded into your brain, which is preventing you from doing it, which is why oftentimes you see the guys lash out and they're super anti-gay. You know, whether it's Ted Haggard, he was one who was caught, or it's somebody like Brian Fisher, who almost certainly at some point will be caught, but if he doesn't get caught, I'm still convinced he's deep in that closet, or any of the other ones. I mean, there are lists of like the top 10 or top 20 anti-gay pastors, anti-gay preachers who are gay. So he's describing that in great detail here, and I think the solution, or the way that we can get some people away from the fundamentalist religious ideologies, is to point out that your innate feeling, or in this, you know, the sexual desire that these guys have for other men, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, this idea that this very basic urge where you're not really hurting anybody else, that like, oh, well, this is wrong. Why would that be any more wrong than hunger? Like, you're hungry and you're craving some food and you eat some food and then you're not hungry anymore. For guys like this, you're horny and you want to fuck a dude and then you fuck a dude and then it's over. Like, and then you feel fine. We have to try to get that through to people, that as long as you're not physically hurting anybody else, what you're doing is not wrong. The same thing goes with drug use. I mean, that's another thing that some extremists might be totally against, and you can never do any, ever. Well, but wait a second. If you're somebody who smoke weed and you like smoking weed and you haven't smoked it in a while and you feel like smoking weed, well, why not smoke weed and then, you know, scratch the itch, and then you're good. And then 3 days from now, you might want to do it again. Who cares? You're not hurting anybody. And it's something that you want to do, and it's innate. You know you want to do it. You can't try to pretend. I mean, for sexuality especially, you can't just pretend. I'm not into that. Everybody knows, and I know this is always TMI when I talk about it, but I've spoken about what kind of women I'm into by and large. I like big hips and big asses on women, okay? And for I think about me trying to deny that, and I laugh, because I can't deny it. I can't fight that. I just like it. There's nothing I can do to stop it. It just is what it is. It's no different for a gay person. And once you understand that whatever your preference is, that other people have different preferences that are just as strong, well, then the only answer can be tolerance and open-mindedness and reason. And to explain to people that the innate secular values that you have are not wrong. As long as you're not hurting anybody, you can do it. And then also a very important final thing I want to mention about this. This is the power of belief. So there are a lot of people who on the left who are anti-Sam Harris and anti-New Atheists. And I've always maintained from the beginning that I view myself as kind of in between the two crowds, where I agree with the progressive side on many, many things and how they focus on geopolitics and imperialism and stuff like that. So I agree with the progressives on that. And with the New Atheists, you'll never find an instance of me saying that they're just flat out wrong when talking about the link between doctrine and action, because they're not wrong about that. They're 100% right about that, and they're some of the only people talking about that. Now, sometimes they might over-invoke it, and sometimes a specific terrorist attack might be a little more complicated, where the motivations for it were a mix of anger over intervention and believing in ideology. So it does get complicated, don't get me wrong. But here we have a perfect example of exactly what Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and guys like that are talking about. When they say, no, you don't get it, you can be totally divorced from any rational terrestrial grievance. You can have no claim whatsoever against something that happened to you, brought about by, you know, big, bad, evil American foreign policy in the West. That could have nothing to do with anything. You could have never been affected negatively ever. But simply based on the fact that you were raised in a fundamentalist religious household, in a Salafi household, you believe I should do terrorism. I should do an attack, because he said at the beginning that he began to see the world because his parents were converted and he was part of this group as well. he began to see the world as good versus evil, belief versus unbelief. So anybody who doesn't believe, not only in Islam, but in his specific far-right interpretation of Islam, that you're evil then. So if you're a Shia Muslim, if you're a moderate Sunni, if you're an atheist for sure, if you're a Christian, well, you're just the bad guy. And it's not because those guys ever did anything wrong to you. It's because you are believing this very fundamentalist interpretation of the religion. So this is what they mean when they talk about the link between belief and action. And you can see, it's perfectly clear here, but you could also see it, for example, with cults that everybody killed themselves. They all killed themselves. Why? Because they actually happened to believe the nonsense that the charismatic leader was saying when he said, hey, there's an alien spaceship coming behind the fucking comet and we all need to put on our Nikes and kill ourselves. I forget the name of that group, but that was one of the things, basically. One of the cults that did that. And there are plenty of examples of this. So if you actually believe the myths and believe the fairy tales, you will be inclined to act on it if you actually believe it. So this is a great example of that right here, and it just so happened in this case we lucked out that his innate sense of this life I'm living is a lie and I'm really a gay dude and I really have secular values, that innate sense was able to override the indoctrination, and by the help of reading rational thinkers and secularists, he's able to say, okay, yeah, no, I disagree with this, and this is bullshit. And by the way, he goes on, he's not an atheist anymore. He doesn't say he's an atheist. He says, no, now I'm basically a deist. So whatever, he might be a cultural Muslim, if you will, and, you know, I believe in God, but not a God who reads your thoughts, and just, you know, it's one of those things. So we need to help get people to the point where that innate secular sense of right and wrong overrides whatever kind of fundamentalist religious indoctrination happens to be downloaded into their brain. And yes, we shouldn't deny the fact that some people really do believe in the most fundamentalist extreme interpretations of religion. Great article. You guys really need to go check that out, man. All right, now let's go to Glenn Beck. The guy's fucking losing it, dude. I shouldn't be laughing at it, because that makes me a dick. Glenn Beck lost his shit and nearly started crying in another ridiculous apocalyptic rant.
Here's my warning. I warn you, America.
Mm.
You will be...
Stop crying.
...the darkest nation to ever, ever exist on this planet.
Really?
Evil will not destroy us.
What?
It will pervert us. It will use the technology and the strength that we have. It will use us for dark purposes. In the end, we will beg the Lord above to destroy us. We will beg for destruction to stop the evil that we will bring to this earth. We will make the evil of the 20th century look like rookies. Now, let the media of the world mock me for telling you that there is a statue to Lucifer that has been erected last Saturday in Detroit, and Time magazine says it's really not that big of a deal. Let me tell you, it is a big deal.
Of course.
God will not be mocked on his own land by his own people who are covenant people. And at the same time, on Monday, they remove his words in Oklahoma in the middle of the night.
Oh, just stop embarrassing yourself, Glenn. They still haven't caught on. I'm amazed. I'm amazed that at this late date, they haven't caught on to the fact that the Satanists are trolling you, slapstick. How do you not know this, twat waffle? The whole point is, hey, we're going to put up a ridiculous religious statue on public lands if it's the case that you guys are putting up Christian statues on public lands. Why? Because it's all fairy tales. It's all myths. You don't get to say, my religion is correct, so I will erect a statue on state property, and nobody else could put their mythical statues on the property. No, once you open that door, once you say, we're going to allow religious stuff on public lands, well then, all right, make room, bitch, for the Bhagavad Gita, make room for some Quran shit, make room for the Scientologists, the Mormons, make room for Lucifer. But he doesn't get it. He think like, what do you think is happening? What do you think, a bunch of liberals are sitting around, like the new Black Panthers and Michael Moore are hanging out having a tea party? Irony, tea party's right wing. And they're like, we shall erect a statue of Lucifer to spread our ideology of Luciferism. And what's hilarious is what? The liberals, of course, are people who are pushing for universal health care, universal education, less war. So they're much more in line with what Jesus' philosophy really is, but no, they're evil either way. No, you're so sad, Glenn. You're doing a serious rant about how I can't believe they took down the Ten Commandments in Oklahoma. And there's a Lucifer statue in Detroit. Yeah, but here's the deal that we've been trying to make with you forever. You take down all the Ten Commandments, you take down all the religious statues, we'll take down all the Satan statues, all the shit that we've been doing to troll your punk ass, which obviously you walked right into the trap. You want to make that deal? We'll make that deal right now. In fact, that's the whole point of them trolling you, is to make that fucking deal. And why is he crying? He almost fucking, he was crying at the beginning. He was, his voice was trembling. What are you crying about? Seriously, what, you really think the nation's going to worship Lucifer? And how dare we take down the Ten Commandments? I dare anybody to ask Glenn Beck to go through the Ten Commandments. Will he be able to tell you them? And how many of them are laws, Glenn? We never have that conversation. Why are you not having that conversation? Let's talk about that. What is it, two? Two of them are laws? Most of the shit on the list is fucking ridiculous. Worship your mother and father. Don't fuck your neighbor's wife. Don't worship other gods. What the fuck is... The omnipotent God is very jealous, which is kind of the opposite of omnipotence. And when he says, we'll be the darkest nation to ever exist. These are the guys that launch attacks against the left all the time, saying that we're anti-American. You just said we're going to be the darkest nation to ever exist. Ever exist. That means worse than Stalin, worse than Pol Pot, worse than the Nazis. You said it. I didn't say it. We're going to be the darkest nation to ever exist. As you're almost crying, oh, Lucifer statue. I don't like Lucifer. You're a child. You're such a child. We're over here. We're trying to have reasonable conversations about tax rates and fiscal policy and protectionism versus so-called free trade and the intervention in Yemen. We're trying to have reasonable conversations, and you're fucking nowhere to be seen back there in Narnia. Oh, Lucifer statues, the Ten Commandments. We will be the darkest nation ever. Heed my warning, we're becoming evil. Just leave the political realm already and go, you know, do a sermon in John Hagee's church every Sunday, because you're making that little sense now. All right, moving on. Death penalty stuff. The newspaper, The Oklahoman, is reporting that the wrong execution drug was used in a death penalty case in January. They say, quote, corrections officials used potassium acetate, not potassium chloride, as required under the state's protocol. Potassium chloride, which stops the heart, is the final drug in the state's protocol following a sedative and paralytic. Items used in Charles Frederick Warner's execution were sent to the office of the chief medical examiner, which performed an autopsy. The report said the office received two syringes labeled potassium chloride, but that the 12 vials used to fill the syringes were labeled single-dose potassium acetate injection. After receiving the first drug in the series, midazolam, Warner said, "My body is on fire." But he showed no other signs of distress and was pronounced dead after 18 minutes. It's not supposed to take that long, guys. There were also complications with Clayton Lockett. We covered that story not that long ago. He took 40 minutes to die. He was foaming at the mouth. He was seizing. It was so bad that they called off the execution after they had given him the lethal injection, because they're like, we don't know if he's going to die. We don't know what the fuck's happening. but we're calling it off, even though he might die any minute now, and he did die. 40 minutes in, he was in excruciating pain for 40 minutes, seizing, foaming at the mouth, then he died. And what does our genius Supreme Court say? Cruel, unusual punishment? Nah. Let it keep going. What the fuck is wrong with you guys? If that is not cruel and unusual punishment, you have the most twisted moral code I've ever seen, ever. I mean, clearly that's cruel and unusual punishment. Now, again, people might say, yeah, but they, in one of these cases, they messed up the drug. So, you know, you can't get mad at them for that. No, that's the exact reason to get mad at them and to get rid of the death penalty. Because sometimes mistakes fucking happen because we're only human. So that's the point, man. I love it when people try to strawman people who are against the death penalty and act like, oh, you have sympathy for the person who raped 23 kids and killed them slowly. Of course we don't have sympathy for that person. That's a terrible person. Don't be ridiculous. Our point against the death penalty is sometimes you get the wrong people, which means you just committed murder, and sometimes you just fuck up and you inject them with the wrong thing and you torture them before they die. And if you do that, you did just violate the Constitution. And if you violated the Constitution, well then, you can't do it anymore. You know, the whole idea is, so you're supposed to get the right people. Well, we don't, 4% of the time, according to one study, by the way. So we don't get the right people, so that means we've all funded as taxpayers murder because we killed the wrong person. Doesn't that mean by your own logic, since we're responsible for the murder, we should also get the death penalty too? See, that's the paradox of the death penalty, and there's no escaping that because it's true. If you ever kill the wrong person, well, maybe you should die too because that's what we do. If you kill people, then you have to die. So you just did that. I thought you were the moral person, but you weren't. You got the wrong guy, so should you get the death penalty? No, not me. No, never me. It's just you play with the logic whenever you run into a roadblock. Whenever you're proven wrong, you go, oh, no, stop playing the game of logic now. See, it's just the bottom line is it's not logical to kill people in 2015. Forget the empathy. Forget, you know, bro, like, do you not have a heart? Forget all that hippie shit. I'm telling you right now. Logically, we can't have it for the paradox I just described. Sometimes you inject the wrong thing, sometimes you kill the wrong people. It's over. If we want to be civilized, if we want to abide by the Eighth Amendment, you can't have it. All right, next. Time to go after the PC people. New York Magazine has an interesting article on political correctness, and in the piece, they outline the University of New Hampshire's bias-free language guide. And it basically explains how to talk to people without offending them. So I want to go through some of the list here and buckle up because this is sheer madness. So now the word senior citizen is, quote, problematic. This is on the problematic list. So instead of saying, hey, it's a senior citizen, or it's a, you know, an elder person or an old person. Instead of saying that, you can't say that anymore because you're being offensive. Now you have to say, people of advanced age. Now, I'm warning you guys, as we go through this, it's going to sound like an SNL skit, but it's not. They're dead serious. All right, more. Problematic, poor person. You can't call somebody a poor person. You can't say poor people. Person living at or below the poverty line. That's what you have to say now. Problematic, the word rich. Preferred. Person of material wealth. Problematic, obese or overweight. Preferred, people of size. Oh, that's adorable. Problematic, blind person. Preferred, visually impaired. Problematic, American. Who the fuck ever was angry about that? Problematic, American. Preferred, U.S. citizen or resident of the U.S. Problematic, Caucasian people, preferred, white people, funny how, why do they think that's better, European-American individuals, please. Problematic, guys, you can't say guys when referring to people overall. You can't say, hey guys, if there's a woman involved there. You have to say, hey folks, hey people, you can't say guys. Problematic, opposite sex, preferred, other sex, look at this man, that's it. We've gone too far. Now, here's the thing. These guys think they're being liberal, and they think this is coming from a good place, but you're authoritarians now. So, in other words, the whole idea of being liberal is being open-minded and yes, being tolerant and caring about treating people right. But what you're doing here is, in the pursuit of that goal, you've now swung the pendulum in the other direction, and you've gone too far, to the point where if somebody says the wrong thing, like calls you an American, you're outraged. You can't say American. You have to say resident of the U.S. But now you're just the language police now, and you've become the bad guy because you're going around trying to rigidly enforce arbitrary rules and ideas and concepts. And that's a very right-wing thing. Or in this case, it's not right-wing because these are liberals who are doing this. It's just authoritarian for you to do this. And you're not helping. And that's the main point here is, you know what my theory is on this? It's intellectual laziness. So again, the people who came up with this, they probably meant well. But the thing is, in the pursuit of being good people, they forgot that there's work involved, there's hard work involved. So what I mean by that is, if you want to care about worldly issues and you want to fix things in the world, which makes perfect sense, if you're a liberal, you absolutely should do that. You need to do your homework first. So you need to know, okay, what's wrong in the world? Well, what's wrong in the world is, and we can go through it, American imperialism, hey, here are all the places we invaded, the military-industrial complex is making all this money, here are some facts, here are some figures on that. You know, religious fundamentalism, whether it's Islamic fundamentalism or Christian fundamentalism, you go down a list. These are gigantic, gigantic problems. Corruption, money in politics, the corporations bought the government. Hey, here are some numbers on that. Here are some figures on that. When you do the homework, you find there's plenty of stuff for liberals to get angry about and to get loud about and to try to fix and fix in an aggressive way. But I say this stems from intellectual laziness because they didn't do their homework on any of the things that are really a problem in the world. So what do they do instead? Just whatever pops up around them? They're waiting to get offended and waiting to play the role of the good person and to say, no, that you're wrong and you're being a bad person. Here's how you be a good person. Did you just call me an American? You need to call me somebody resident of the U.S., Did you just say that person was blind? He's visually impaired, goddammit. Did you just call that person rich? That's a person of material wealth, not a rich person. What's wrong with you? Did you just say old person or senior citizen or elder? Fuck, it's a person of advanced age, you goddamn Nazi, you. How dare you be so insensitive? No, I'm not playing this game anymore. To believe in liberalism means you believe in freedom of speech, period. 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 Now, you'll hear me argue with people when they say something stupid, but you'll never hear me say, censor that person. This is bordering on censorship. And again, we've seen this before. So it used to be the case that you can't, you can call immigrants illegal aliens. Then, okay, that's offensive. Then it's illegal immigrants, and then that's still offensive. Then it's undocumented immigrants. And then next week it'll be something else. So you just keep moving the goalposts in an attempt to be a good person. But all you're doing is picking out shit that people say and calling them insensitive for saying it and then making up a new term. That's intellectual sloppiness and laziness, because if you want to be a good person, there's a lot of shit to fix. It's not random normal phrases people use and words people use like American and rich and guys. No, your real focus, if you're a liberal and if you want to make the world a better place, it should be on policy. It should be on corruption and money in politics and imperialism and fundamentalism. Let's stop getting outraged at everything and, you know, making it so that we can't wait to be offended. And let's do our homework and get offended at the right things and fix the right things. And let's not be the PC police. Let's not be speech Nazis. Let's not be against free speech, because again, that's not a liberal idea. That makes you an authoritarian. All right, I'm out of time, guys. I love you. I'll see you tomorrow for an awesome Friday show. Peace.